We've actually looked at the impact of this in people for people over 50 in Ireland and found that loneliness has increased threefold since during and since COVID. And it hasn't gone back once the pandemic abated to baseline levels. There seems to be a lingering effect. I'm calling it the long COVID. There are lots of different versions of long COVID. But for people over the age of 50, this particularly appears to be pervasive and associated with depression, actually.
There was a feisty piece in the Irish Independent at the start of this year by Suzanne Harrington with the headline, "Why I'm Ditching Anti-Aging to Embrace Pro-Aging." And to quote a few lines, "Remember your nan knitting booties in a rocking chair by the fire? Well, today she'd probably be at a festival, a gig, in a camper van, online dating, going running, travelling, living the same life she ever did, except with an older face and a bit more cash. Well, I'm one of those guys who might just want to sign up for a bit of that, and who better to tell me how than Professor Roseanne Kenny of Trinity College Dublin? You're very welcome to the Insights podcast, Professor Kenny. You're also, I should say, Director of the St. James's Hospital Clinical Research Unit for Successful Ageing with 300 staff. And also, you're the head of TILDA, that's the Irish Longitudinal Study on Ageing, going on since 2009. And you've already published 600 reports and 120 policy recommendations. Now, so much to cover, and we'll come on to a lot of that. But one of the many things on your CV is that you're a Regius professor. Now, that suggests that you've got royalty or connections with royalty. How did that come about?
Well, the name is a hangover, I expect. There are a few Regius positions on these islands, and it's an honorary appointment. I'm the 24th such Regius for physic, which is the old word for medicine, as it were, body, physical. So I'm the medical regis, the first female. And they were established by George the First in 1600s.
There's a bit of tradition for you.
So that's where the regis starts from, and it's been retained.
Right. And you've been at this work now for, I think it's about 35 years or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. How did you get interested in working with older patients? What sparked your interest?
When I was a junior doctor, I loved the holistic approach that then geriatric medicine has and still has. It very much retained that, which involved all members of staff. It was a very egalitarian approach, actually, to the patient, where each healthcare professional had a voice and had an input into the patient's management. And I really liked that, you know, physiotherapists, occupational therapists, nursing staff, of course, as well as clinicians and social workers. So that attracted me to geriatric medicine when I was training. And I resolved to do it then, although it was a very unpopular specialty at the time. It was difficult to attract anybody, you know, really into the specialty at the time. They were struggling.
What were people going for maybe predominantly at the time? Was it pediatric stuff or coronary care?
Or surgery or neurology. I mean, I actually did neurology somewhat initially, and then I did, my research was all in cardiology because I was interested in the association between the heart and the head and how cardiovascular things affect head function and obviously ultimately how they influence dementia.
I understand that your father didn't enjoy great health in his latter years. Did that influence your speciality in some way?
Definitely. My father was a medic, but he developed multiple sclerosis very early on in his life. He was working for 7 years in Canada then at the time, as was the way with many who emigrated once they completed their college years. And he had a very aggressive form of multiple sclerosis. So I guess from a caring perspective, I was exposed to that at a very early age. Also, I remember we were involved in the Multiple Sclerosis Society in Ireland, and my mum would take patients out for a drive, and I'd go with her on a Sunday when we were young. I remember one very young man who was living in rural Ireland, an only child, and they didn't have any transport of their own. So we frequently took him and befriended him. And then he became ill, as is the case in MS, then particularly with urinary tract infections or pneumonia. And he was admitted to a so-called nursing home at the time. I'll never forget it. It was an old home, and we called to visit him there. And the lady who owned the nursing home, so-called, took us down to the basement, the bowels of the house, where there was no paint or decoration on any of the walls. They were weeping in my memory. And into this large room, which was a basement room, with just beds on either side. And at the top of the room, I remember a commode. And the lid was open, and there was urine and feces in the commode. And just the whole, and he had bed sores, and just the whole thing was Dickensian and nightmarish.
We're not exactly talking prehistoric times here. Are we talking about the 70s?
We're not talking about, 80s, early 80s. So that really struck me at the time. And I just thought, this is terrible, that this is an acceptable way to look after anyone. I recall very much how I felt with respect to that.
And like a lot of distinguished medical graduates, you did your primary studies in Galway.
A very proud Galway graduate and an alumni of a great university there.
Can't argue with that. And this business of ageism, I mean, where are we along the road, I suppose, internationally, or maybe more importantly or more relevantly, as where you should see us going in regard to showing respect and, you know, according people their rights and their dignity and so forth?
It is about rights and it is about dignity. Absolutely. I think it's proved an awful lot in Ireland. There's more awareness with respect to ageism, but we're not nearly as advanced as other biases. And I think that COVID actually unmasked that quite well. When it came to protecting people, the immediate policy response was people over the age of 70 should not go out. And if you unmask that, the implication is, because we don't need you in society.
Or was it not that they were more vulnerable and therefore in greater need of protection?
They were more vulnerable, but in need of protection I found it patronising. I think that people should have been informed themselves. I have a great story of one of my patients. He was a runner. He was 82. And he was out running and passed one of his neighbours. This is at the time when we were cocooning, allegedly.
Another word you loved.
And he was running past the neighbour, and the neighbour shouted at him, I won't say his name, Mickey, do you not know that over 70s are supposed to be staying in? And he kept running and turned his head back and responded, they said nothing about over 80s. So, I mean, that's attitude. That's and he was, of course, perfectly right. So I think that COVID unmasked a lot of ageist attitude, but also gave people like myself and others in the field an opportunity to actually raise awareness about that, which was a good thing.
Were you or colleagues, were you part of the COVID, I forget now what the thing that Tony Houlihan chaired, that central organising committee laying down the law for the rest of it?
We weren't part of it. We fed into it, gave information. And I run, as you said in your introduction, the Tilda study. We did a whole lot of work looking in another way, repurposing our data to actually try and help policymakers to understand where need was, where community-based healthcare workers were most needed, because they themselves were trying to repurpose staff at the time back into the acute healthcare sector.
Yeah, but that word, we kind of passed over it, but maybe you have more to say about it. That word cocooning, that really stuck in your craw, didn't it?
It did not, but not just mine, but yes, it did. I felt it was patronising, actually, and, you know, wrapping people up. And although the recommendations were not mandatory to remain indoors, there was the suggestions around it and the language around it was so strong at the time. When we asked, again, and we did waves of the Tilda study during and after COVID, people's interpretation of cocooning and the other recommendations were that it was mandatory, actually, and that they had to stay in. When we look at language, elderly is never used, not recommended. People don't like being called elderly. You are elderly. That is not popular.
Okay, so older. It should be older, right.
Older persons.
And what about something like senior citizen?
Yeah, so it's senior citizen is elderly is bottom of the pile. Senior citizen is acceptable. And most people opt for being referred to as an older person.
What are the kind of learnings, to use that word, I'm not sure I like it or not, or what advice would you give to a new expert group about how a future pandemic would be dealt with, and what would you do differently? In other words,
well, I'm not the expert in this, and obviously there's a lot of official questioning around this whole area at the moment, looking back at practice and see what the best practice might be, and particularly in the UK, of course, as we speak. But I would say that we will never go back to the same level of loss of independence and for any age group that we did. Because we know how bad that is. And we've actually looked at the impact of this in people for people over 50 in Ireland, and found that loneliness has increased threefold since during and since COVID. And it hasn't gone back once the pandemic abated to baseline levels. There seems to be a lingering effect. I'm calling it the long COVID. There are lots of different versions of long COVID. But for people over the age of 50, this particularly appears to be pervasive and associated with depression, actually. And almost a loss of confidence and an inability to reinvigorate the activities that they were engaged with before COVID. And that's the societies are finding the same thing. Associations which were part of a social engagement network are finding the same thing, that participation has dropped.
Yeah, we're kind of like 2 years on from the ultimate, you know, sort of lifting of the restrictions and so forth, and still the residue is there.
Yeah, that's right.
And more than a residue.
Yeah,
maybe.
More than a residue. It's very much lingering. That's why it's a long COVID effect. And there was a recent study, and I'm not sure how much COVID has contributed to this, but I suspect hugely, which looked at loneliness across Europe. And it's been since COVID. And actually found Ireland was bottom of the list when it came to loneliness. Now, our own work would not confirm relatively that we were bottom, but certainly that loneliness was becoming much more common in Ireland, and social isolation. And that is not good news, because social engagement and having friends and meeting people and being active is an anti-inflammatory. It reduces stress.
You put that right up at the top of your list.
100%. Yeah.
What people should prioritize.
Yes, I do. I think it's terribly important. Not that I think it's terribly important. I know it matters. I know it matters to physical and brain health.
What kind of proportion or percentage of people would report feelings of loneliness then throughout your Tilda study?
Oh, well, we asked the question in different ways, because there's a spectrum, but people who have experienced at some stage in a week painful loneliness could be in excess of 20%, and sometimes 25%, so one in four. Painful loneliness is pretty much an extreme of loneliness, where you get a pain in your chest, literally, when lonely. But the good news for me about that is we can do something about it. Loneliness as a society, as a country, is something we should be able to do something about. And we need to look at the different factors that are contributing to it in terms of the environment and household structures, and do something about it.
Does it vary from place to place, city, country, you know, towns, villages? What have you learned there?
So absolutely it does. It is not much more frequent in cities than in rural Ireland, which is interesting, because we'd always assumed otherwise. There aren't huge gender differences. There are some, but not huge. Men are not as good as women at integrating and interacting and having social networks. But apart from that, there isn't huge variation. It's across the age spectrum, because we've been involved in childhood studies and adolescent studies and young adult studies, as well as older adults. And it is very much across the spectrum, but much more common as people get older.
And you mentioned earlier that loneliness can be an inflammatory.
Yeah, this is it. So probably when we look at what causes aging, what's happening at a cellular level, that cells get old and die, because that's what happens to them. And then actually, when they die, there's a toxic process that takes place, which makes more cells die. So we're studying why does that happen. And one of the big contendants for why that is inflammation. Now, inflammation is a great thing. It's a good thing. When we get a bacterial infection, when we get a viral infection, we have an inflammatory response. We've evolved like that. It's important. But then after the pathogen, whatever caused the insult, has gone away, has been killed, has been sorted out, the inflammatory response goes right down to baseline. Okay, so there's no more inflammation. However, if you have pervasive invaders, like worry, like stress, like loneliness, then you are more likely to have a chronic inflammation because the body perceives it just as it would perceive a bacteria or virus, and it's constantly trying to fight against it. That's bad for our system.
And what can it lead to?
Earlier cancer, more aggressive cancer, very much to heart disease, stroke, and dementia is another big thing that it can lead to. Yeah.
So I suppose the moral of that particular story is loneliness is something that, as you say, we can do something about. Yeah. And if we don't, well, there are consequences.
If we don't, not only that, there are consequences for the individual, which are unnecessary and untenable as a society. But also, it will have an impact going forward on our health system. And already our health system is under huge pressure. So there are lots of very good reasons for us to work at this as a society.
One of the points you've often made, you've made it in your book, Age Proof, The New Science of Living a Longer and Healthier Life, is that only a small proportion, I think it's about 20% of what happens to us health-wise and aging-wise is actually genetic. Mm. The rest of it, the full 80% is, well, to a large extent, within our own control.
Absolutely. I mean, we know this from identical twin studies. So their genes are exactly the same, but we can measure biological aging through epigenetic clocks, for example, which are clocks in the cell. And we know that if the twins who are genetically exactly the same don't have the same rate of biological aging. Then when you drill down into what are the factors that's different from one twin to the next, it's the generic term is environmental factors. It means all the things we're talking about, social engagement, loneliness, but also lifestyle behaviors, physical activity, smoking, diet, relationships, etc. So there's a whole load of environmental things that make a difference.
This longitudinal study, Tilda, you've got, what is it, about 6,000 people that are regularly surveyed. You've produced 600 papers and 120 policy documents. Mm. I mean, there must be standout elements in that. I mean, there must be four or five or six really big ones to highlight.
So, yeah, absolutely. We're actually following 10,500 people now because we refreshed the sample. And the good news, before I answer your last question, is we have been awarded the WHO Centre for such studies worldwide. So that's a very, well, clearly that's a great achievement for Ireland to have been designated that. But it's a reflection of the study. There are a number of standout things. One of them, we've done obviously a whole lot of work on social engagement. I won't go into that again. But also it's undiagnosed treatable conditions. So, for example, with high blood pressure, which is the commonest modifiable thing we can do to prevent dementia, for example, and stroke. In the age group 50 to 60, 40% of people who have high blood pressure don't know they have it. 40%. So it's quite remarkable. And it's more common that one wouldn't know they had an underlying condition, hypertension or high cholesterol or depression, for example, if you're in higher socioeconomic groupings, if you don't have a medical card, in other words. So people with medical cards are more likely to be aware of those of illnesses than persons who don't have medical cards and are paying for their health system, health attendance.
That sounds paradoxical, really, doesn't it?
Well, yeah.
And what difference would it make if they were to have knowledge of their high blood pressure?
Oh, these are the most powerful things which slow down the aging process for a start. Okay. So dealing with blood pressure, dealing with cholesterol, taking aspirin should you need it, etc., managing BMI, all of those modifiable factors have a huge impact on the pace of aging and what diseases you're likely to get as you get older.
So, well, presumably if people had even annual checkups or visits to their GP, they would be in a position to find out about, this 40% would be in a position to find out about their blood pressure.
And this is the thing. I used to say, once you've hit 50, you know, congratulations, happy birthday, what's your blood pressure?
Yeah, and welcome Sniper Alley.
I think people should actually be aware of all of those things. And we should have some system for screening. And I've even proposed that we might better utilise pharmacies to do screening, walk-in screening of all of the things that we really should know from 50 onwards that are very easy to measure.
So you would mention blood pressure, Cholesterol.
Blood pressure, cholesterol, BMI, which is a combination of body mass index, weight and height, your diabetes status. And for that, the best measure is hemoglobin A1C. It's a blood test. Even if you knew those four things, they are the most modifiable factors that have very easy to treat and make a difference.
But you see, if you knew those things, you might have to do something about.
So then those persons who are abnormal with respect to the tests would have to attend a general practitioner, have medications prescribed, and then be monitored.
I suppose, to quote somebody I've been watching in regard to advice he gives about weight loss, a lot of the answers to these things, they're simple, but they're not easy. And you mentioned things like social engagement, you mentioned things like diet, you mentioned things like exercise. Diet. And I think you talk as well about, is it blue zones where people have been living longer and living more healthily? And so what are they and what can we learn from them?
The blue zones are five zones in the world where proportionately much more people live to 100 and beyond, but not only live to 100 and beyond, live to 100 and beyond without having to the same level the diseases we constantly associate with the aging process. So they live healthily. And they're Okinawa, near Japan, it's an island. Icaria, also an island off Greece. Sardinia, off the coast of Italy. Nicoya in Costa Rica. And Lima Lunda in California.
No mention of Inishmore or Arranmore or Tory.
Actually, you know what? It isn't one of the blue zones, but Orkney Island, north of Scotland. They're healthy life years. That's years spent without any disease or diagnosis or disability is 75.4 compared to Blackpool, which is 53.4. So that's some very interesting data not too far away from us. That's not lifespan, that's healthy lifespan. That's without a disease.
The fresh cod and batter and single.
No, it's definitely, that's it. But also the social engagement apparently there is very active. And physical activity and a lot of walking. And that's what we see in the blue zones. There's a lot of physical activity, not purposeful, but built into the day. They walk everywhere. They walk up inclines frequently. Many of them are well above sea level. They're all beside the sea. They have amazing communities.
And what about, you know, their sense of proportion about, say, food intake? They don't stuff themselves.
No, this is one of the factors. Actually, a good collaborator of ours in Telda lived, was working in the university in Sardinia for a few years. He was from mainland Italy. And I asked him that because he was very exercised about what, about biological aging and the factors that influence it. And his main observation was the difference between mainland Italy and Sardinia was Sardinians do not eat nearly as much or as frequently as mainland Italy. And that's been borne out by good research studies.
Which brings us to a kind of related topic, given that we're talking about Italy and Sardinia. The Mediterranean diet is something, the praises of which you sing quite loudly.
Yeah, it's definitely the diet that has by far the most research done about it. I sing Mediterranean plus. So that's Mediterranean plus berries.
Yeah. The reason I ask you this in part is because I happen to be on a flight from Miami fairly recently. And as is my wont, I love to pick up a hard copy of a newspaper. And I got the Sunday edition of the New York Times and their cooking supplement. I think it runs to about 40 pages or thereabouts. It has a special on the Mediterranean diet, healthy, simple and delicious, right? And
yes,
there's all these things like chickpea salad sandwiches, huevos rancheros, sweet pan feta with chickpeas and so forth. In all of the 40 pages, there's not a scrap of meat in it. There's no red meat. I think there might be a mention of chicken. And it's like
chicken,
page 39 before you get to salmon. I mean, like, is this war on red meat now that you're part of?
I'm personally not war on red meat because I think the jury is out. And again, from an evolutionary perspective, it's interesting. I mean, we are carnivores and we've evolved as carnivores. But the research to date, it has to be said, with respect to red meat, is not promising. Now, you must remember that very little red meat that we ingest now is hormone-free or purely organic. And it may well be that that's complicating factors, that it isn't the red meat per se, but the other associations.
Well, no, we have very, very severe restrictions in this country and in Europe generally about the kind of things that can be injected into beef animals, which is why people are warning us about imports from South Africa, or sorry, South America and other places.
Yeah, but their food stuff. You know, the foodstuffs aren't, they're not on the pasture day and night with natural foods. Possibly, that's a possible explanation. The World Health Organization is certainly guarded against a lot of intake of red meat because in their evaluation, their research evaluation, it accelerates cancers, particularly bowel cancers.
These are the same guys who tell us that there's no such thing as a safe level of alcohol consumption.
You're on a very comfortable note there, Sean.
That's why I say it's simple, but it mightn't be that easy.
No, and it's not. And medicine isn't black or white, which is what's so, I suppose, interesting, but also complicated about it. I wouldn't say there isn't a safe level of alcohol consumption, but the certainly the thresholds which we and I as a doctor have been exposed to of 14 and 21 units a week, very few people who are regular drinkers adhere to that. And the early evidence that they were based on is questionable. You see, there are other confounders, because if you only drink when you're with other people and having a laugh, you're probably counteracting some of the negative elements of alcohol. There is definitely good data that lifelong teetotalers who are not entirely miserable in terms of their personality types, etc., actually do live longer. They are healthier in the measurements. But for drinkers, I think I advise in moderation and, if possible, with others, not to drink alone.
Yeah, one of the other conversations we've had in this series of insights is with Jarlett Burns, the new president of the GAA, who has been a lifelong pioneer. He said, you know, he's never met anybody who was a teetotaler who regretted the fact.
Yes.
I don't know if you have.
I wouldn't be a teetotaler. But
you might meet the odd one.
Oh, no, I do, of course. Yeah, no. And I mean, I know from our studies that that teetotalers actually, generally speaking, have longer healthy lifespan than drinkers. Now, I'm sure that doesn't apply to the Orkney Islands. So that's why I'm saying it's not that simple. And, you know, even though you go into great detail in the facts and details you're collecting when you're doing studies as Tilde's and other studies, it's almost impossible to completely adjust for all potential confounders.
You recently got awarded, I think, another 15 million euro to continue the work of Tilde. I mean, what have you not found out that you can still find out into the future? I mean, with your 600 reports and now with your 10,000 subjects.
That's what's so interesting about it. How is Ireland changing? What is the 50-year-old 16 years ago like compared to today's 50-year-old? And what are the factors that are changing? The similar study in the USA started in 1992 and they continue to this day and they continue to grow simply because it's very interesting to watch those cohort changes. The other thing is that we have an opportunity to understand what's called natural experiments. Now, COVID was a natural experiment. So what kind of an impact does that have and what are the long-term sequelae? The recession was a natural experiment that we looked at. The impact that had on people's quality of life as well as health.
Yes, and Tilde started just about as the crash had happened and we were beginning to see the consequences and have to deal with them.
Absolutely. And, you know, we had a resounding response rate because to the study at that time. And I'm personally convinced it was because people over the age of 50 wanted to give back. They wanted to do something positive. The Germans went into the field around the same time and their response rate at that time was something like 37%. In other words, 37%. Of people whose doors they knocked on and asked would they take part in a study who were eligible for inclusion said yes. In Ireland, it was 67%. So there just seemed to be a great willingness for that age cohort to help. The terrible hemorrhage, which you will remember, that we experienced as a society of young people who finished university and had to leave. There were no jobs. So we went through that whole impact on emigration of recession again. And I think that was the age cohort's way of maybe somehow positively influencing that hemorrhage.
So what have you established or found out Professor Kenny, just from that, following or tracking these people, say from 2009 onwards, I mean, have they changed their lifestyles? And in one sense, is there a difficulty about going back to the same people, because they know they're part of the study and maybe they feel either prompted, prodded or incentivized into wanting to do better themselves in a way that doesn't really reflect wider society?
Well, the way we chose the sample, it's a representative sample. That was hard. That was costly. And just may I pay deference to the great Chuck Feeney. He saw that when we approached him about doing the study, that Ireland desperately needed its own data set. At the time, we were making policy decisions from Scottish data sets, and he supported us with respect to that. We have found actually that behaviours don't change that much. We do give some information back to participants, and the behaviours, they vary maybe between waves by about 5%. So even though somebody knows their BMI is excessive and cholesterol up and blood pressure, they don't necessarily continually modify that or do something about it, which is interesting in terms of behaviour. The other behavioural thing which we've noted after retirement is people who are volunteering, either volunteering with NGOs or some community organisations, or volunteering with grandchildren and grandparenting, they have a slowing of the aging process. They're much more less likely to be depressed and have a significantly better quality of life, adjusted for all other factors. And the other interesting thing we've noticed that I love is that the more positive you are about aging, the younger you feel, the younger you are biologically.
Which brings us to a point you make about not asking your patients their age.
No.
Which suggests I better not ask you what age you are.
Correct.
But you are prepared to talk about biological age, which you think is the really important
one. But biological age is what matters, yeah. And using what's called chronological age, that's the number of candles on a birthday cake, is meaningless. And you know this, and the listeners will know this. Think of two, I'll use chronological age, 84-year-olds who are very, very different. And they're different because they're biologically different. So everything that's gone up to make up their life course up until that point, all of their experiences, all of their habits, etc., that's what influences how they perform at that chronological age. We can measure biological aging, and it's not that inaccurate now, using epigenetic clocks. They're little cell clocks within the cell. And there can be a difference as much as 10 years, in some people 15 years, in biological clocks and chronological age. So your biological age is what matters. But for us, at a population level, the best markers of biological age are your cholesterol, hemoglobin A1C, weight, and physical activity, physical strength, muscle strength.
So what has Tilda been able to establish about the difference between people's biological and chronological ages then?
You know, the biggest driver for better biological aging is your level of education, apart from smoking. And smoking is really detrimental and can add, on average, 8 years to age, to your biological aging. So it's by far the most toxic thing. But education is huge, education in childhood. Then there are other things which, again, it's childhood, which is interesting, which influence the aging process. And that's adverse experiences in childhood, like divorce in a family, alcoholism in a family, poverty, which has a negative impact on the family infrastructure, etc. Those negative consequences actually appear to linger and get under the skin and accelerate the aging process later on.
This isn't necessarily poverty when people are old, but it could include that, but it could be poverty as they go through life, and then that in turn brings certain
stresses.
Well, it's
in childhood, actually. It's childhood. So actually, if we could get childhood experiences right, childhood education, offering opportunities, security in a household, then we would get the long-term health of our society. It would be much fitter and much better. And it's interesting, even in that context, that even children who are maybe isolated or going through a difficult time, what they need is a significant other. So the big deficit is if a child is having adverse experiences and doesn't have exposure to a significant other that they can go to, who can share their problems, those children are the ones who do worse and who age worse, if you like, but they have more difficulties in adolescence, in midlife, as well as in older age.
And is that something that you see kind of moving through into their middle and subsequent years?
Absolutely.
And that's shown up in your own research?
Yes, it's shown up in our own research. So they get diseases that we would associate with aging much earlier than others do. So I guess for me, that's one of the most important things that we've helped to identify, that childhood experiences matter hugely, and that as a society we should be really addressing those experiences and offering some support for with a significant other.
What kind of influence on policy has your work had, and your colleagues as well, obviously?
I can give you a number of examples. One of them was because of the high blood pressure data I spoke about, and the lack of awareness of high blood pressure and therefore the consequences. 24-hour remuneration to general practitioners for doing 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure. The Department of Health, in fairness to them, introduced that almost overnight. When they saw that data. We've done a lot of work on blackouts and falls, and we found that about a third of people, as they got older, who have a blackout or a fall, that it's because of some sort of underlying cardiovascular abnormality, which was not previously known, that you can do something about. So then we translated that into work in St. James's, where we have dedicated consultants who are experts in this in the emergency room, and seeing these people as they come through, and rather than admitting them to hospital, taking them to a specialist falls and blackout unit, investigating them, and then treating abnormalities. And that has significantly reduced hospital admission for those symptoms, but also readmission. So it's been very successful.
And it's also the point, I think, at which families find themselves facing into these conversations that may have the idea of transferring a parent to a nursing home because of the fear of falls and blackouts, that they're simply not able to look after themselves.
Absolutely. And fear of falling is one of the commonest reasons, or falling, for persons to go into nursing homes. So, I mean, it's 15% of all adult attendances are because of a fall or a blackout. So I have to say now, what the result of the experiment in James's has been, that we now have permanent staff running that service, but also in collaboration with HRB and HSE, we're doing a national audit to see what's happening in other hospitals and whether we can actually now take this model of investigation and intervention into other hospitals. In James's alone, it has saved the equivalent of 12 million a year. It's the equivalent of a 12-bedded medical ward a year. Now, that gives huge opportunity to properly utilise beds. And also, when you admit people to hospital, particularly as they get older, unfortunately, the longer they stay, the frailer they get, because they're not moving around. A patient isn't in their own environment. The stimulation isn't the same as it would be in their own environment. So it isn't good for people to be in hospital unless absolutely necessary. It's not good for any age group, but particularly as we get older, because we're much more likely to decondition and muscles become weak.
So looking at the work that you're going to do with this extra 15 million, or this new 15 million, what are you going to look at?
So we'll have three waves of the study, and it's actually very expensive to kind of collate that sort of data. Every 2 years, we'll see people. We do three sort of things with Tilda. We go into someone's home and do a face-to-face interview, and it's what we call an omnibus study. That means we collect data on everything from finances, preparedness for retirement, through to social network, what the household is like, diseases in childhood, life, their life course experiences, etc. We ask about what they know about illnesses, mental health, and then we bring them into the centre and we do objective testing, which takes 3.5 hours. And also for more private questions and answers, we have a self-completion questionnaire. It's a very intense assessment, and, you know, hats off to the amazing participants who take part in this research experiment, which has changed so very, very much. And we do that every 2 years. And hopefully we will continue to inform policy and practice as a result of that. We are developing our own epigenetic clock, a Tilda clock, because a number of our measures are quite unique in the world of these studies. And we would expect to be able to make that available to people so that you could tell me, Sean, exactly what your biological aging is without my having to know the number of candles on the birthday cake.
Yeah, well, as the years go by, you have to get more and more candles for obvious for obvious reasons. But it was hearting to do one of those tests on the walking machine.
Oh,
and
yes.
You're all sort of hooked up with these pads and so forth, to be told. The last one I did, I was 25% fitter than I was the previous
time.
I don't know what,
that's
I don't know what that says for my biological
that's
age.
That's very good. And actually, you've reminded me of one of the things that we changed with the policy. We do that walking task. We use what we call a magic carpet, which has sensors in it. And we can get all sorts of walking parameters from that: gait, stride, length, width, etc., how long you spend on one leg or the other, and turning. And then we give people tasks to do: carry a full glass of water, or say every second letter of the alphabet, etc., so that they're being a little bit stressed. And then we look at walking speed in the context of that. And we found that almost 30% of people over 75 in Ireland, when we took traffic signalling times as well, working with the Dublin County Council at the time, 30% weren't able to cross the road on time because we knew their walking speeds from changing amber to red. And then we explored that further.
Should try doing it in Miami, as I was doing recently.
Awful.
It's frightening.
But then what do you do? You don't go out. If you know that you mightn't make it and you're concerned or worried about that, then there's some degree loss of independence and you get somebody else to do something for you.
Speaking of independence, what about driving? Because there is a balance, I think, to be struck between safety and freedom. I mean, I recall one of my children, now well into her adulthood and motherhood, saying, I think it's a 10 or 11 year old, they were being picked up from school. Why are all those people beeping at Grandad? Which suggests there might have been certain errors being made. And like, this was a man who had 70 years of accident-free driving. So how do you approach those things?
Well, there are pretty strict criteria actually about with respect to ability to drive and cognitive function, you know, brain function. And the ultimate way to approach that is to actually do a driving test directed at older persons, and there is such a thing. So that's the best complete way. Driving is very often, if you're familiar with the course, a learned experience. And think of yourself, you might drive home from here to home and you probably won't even remember the way you took as you're doing it, because it's just rote. So that's difficult then to get that balance, acknowledging that it's almost an automatic process and risk. And of course, driving is terribly important for people in rural Ireland, for many people in rural Ireland. It is their ticket. It is their independence. And without it, they can be very isolated. So you have to strike the right balance. You have to take those factors into consideration whilst being very aware of risk. I had great hopes for automatic self-drive vehicles. I thought that it would just open up so many opportunities for people, particularly in rural Ireland, with of all ages.
Had, as opposed to have.
Well, I mean, it's been around for an awful long time now. I remember having discussions with a major Japanese car firm. We were doing research with them. They were trying to make a car a laboratory. They wanted to use all of our kind of external signals to diagnose changes in our biodynamics using the internal aspect of a car. And I said to them, and what about automatic cars or self-driving cars, etc.? And they said, oh no, we're there, we've done that. There's nothing more to be done on that. That's purely about regulations. This is 10 years ago. That's purely about regulations. We're just waiting for the regulations to change. We've moved on now in terms of the science as a major car company. So I did say had, because I don't see it coming up today or tomorrow.
Well, maybe you'll still be working when it's still or when it does become available. I mean, what are your own personal ambitions in terms of your career? I mean, are you bound by, you know, hitting a certain age and then having to fold your tent and just go off and do all those things like, you know, getting a motorhome and going to festivals and whatever that we spoke about at the outset?
Maybe I do that anyway. I don't have to retire. I'm not bound by a retirement age, which is a very comfortable position to be in. I don't actually consider anything which some people refer to as work for me personally. I love everything I'm doing at the moment. I'm still doing clinical practice and I really enjoy my clinical practice. And I do a lot of research. And with each day, there's something more interesting in research that I think, gosh, it'd be great to get to the bottom of that or to understand why that's happening.
So do you practice what you preach as well about things like diet, exercise, all those things?
I actually, I do. I do. I mean, I'm pretty wedded to Mediterranean diet. I'm not a teetotaler. I love a nice red wine with friends. I have cold showers every morning and I swim in the sea every weekend. I like cold swimming very much. I do exercise, yeah. And I've always liked the
gym. You did mention cold water. And as part of my preparation for our conversation today, I did turn the shower to cold this morning for about maybe 2 minutes and said, my God, you know, how could this possibly be any good for me?
Yeah, it is, though. It is. It's very good for the autonomic nervous system. It triggers great benefit for in our automatic system, which is ticking away in the background all the time, and ultimately enhances the parasympathetic activity, which is the one you want to kind of focus on, having stimulated sympathetic. But it also releases feel-good hormones, dopamine in particular, serotonins.
Yeah, I can see why that might be the case as part of my all year round swimming in the months of June to September, but not necessarily this time of year. I'm wondering as well about how long one can expect to enjoy a good life into old age as an older person. I mean, a friend of mine has a pub in the Midlands and he hosted a party for one of his customers who I think was kind of like well into his 80s. And some of the people there, some of his nieces started to joke with him. I said, well, you know, tell me, Michael, I don't know if his name was Michael. At what age does a man start losing interest in, you know, romance and all that goes with it? And he said, you'd want to ask an older man than me, was his answer. So I'm just wondering, I mean, where intimacy and sex lives are concerned, I mean, what are the prospects?
Well, I mean, it's indefinite, I would say. Sexual drive declines for both genders as we get older. But we found in Tilda that within couples, sexual activity was not uncommon once a month, once a week, once every 2 weeks, and that those who were sexually active and enjoying sexual activity actually had a far better quality of life overall and better mental health and physical health. Now, it's hard, again, to disaggregate. Were they sexually active because they had better status, even though we could follow them longitudinally, which pretty much gives you a causal association, which is cause, which is effect or not. And it looked like sexual activity is the cause predominantly of the better outcome. There are medical interventions in terms of medications or management of problems with ejaculation or impotency in men that work.
And to another activity, I suppose, that takes place in the bedroom as well, that's sleep. Mm-hmm. And I remember somebody advising me to read a book called Why We Sleep. Mm. And I think the first, well, let's say it was 200 pages long, 195 pages were about all the awful things that would happen to us if we didn't sleep, you know, the full amount or 7-8 hours. And then there was about 3 pages of things you could do that you could read in any Tuesday's copy of the Daily Mail. Mm. So you have maybe a bit more of a fluid or
I'm attitude. More flexible in my approach to it, but it's not just me, based on science. There's some
Matthew Walker, I think, was the author.
Yeah, he's very good. There's a really good science called Foster in Oxford.
Well, he wasn't very good for me now, I can
tell you. Well, I don't disagree with you because that doesn't help you, particularly if you have your own sleep patterns that doesn't align.
Sleeping
with whatever.
Sleeping much better now, by the way, yeah.
Well, retirement might have helped with
semi.
That. Semi-retirement. So anyway, I would say that, first of all, the most important thing is not to worry about your sleep, because that's far more toxic than any sleep or not sleep you're going to get. Secondly, we must accept there are different sleeping patterns. And even scientists in this area have different experiences of sleeping. And the optimum, of course, is 7 to 9 hours at night. Very few people, particularly as they get older, get that or get it unbroken. You're very lucky if you do. And even doing all of the right things that you know you can do, lots of people don't manage to do that. So just to get the optimum sleep for you, be happy with that. Be satisfied with that. There are things you can do. Blue light is deadly. If you can leave the phone outside, do. I can't, because I like to go to sleep listening to In Our Time on BBC Four. Melvin Bragg, his voice puts me to sleep. So, but if you can leave the phone outside, fine. Not to look at, avoid blue light for an hour, probably before sleep. And certainly not to scroll the phone before you sleep. And also exercise is good, but not too close to sleeping, because you get your sympathetic activity peaking, and that's not good for sleeping. Hot baths, dark room. And your room should be like a cave. The bed warm, but the room cool and really dark. Really, really dark. And that way we work our circadian rhythms to their maximum. So we switch them on, trigger them at the beginning of the day, and we turn them off at night.
And for general health as well, Roseanne, I think you recommend that we confine our eating, our food intake to certain hours.
Yeah. So if you can confine your food intake to a 6 to 8 hour window, that's optimum in the day. And that means...
Breakfast at 12 and dinner at 6?
That's what I do. Well, I have breakfast at 12 and dinner at 7. Yeah, yeah. And my main meal is what you call breakfast. It's a big lunch. Before I came into you, I had a big Tupperware pot of Mediterranean stuff that I chopped up this morning.
And nothing before you went to your lecture then?
No, I didn't. No, coffee. Mm. I do like my coffee in the morning.
You're probably doing a bit of fasting as well while you're at it.
Well, that is fasting. So that's a 16-hour fast. And fasting, we know now, is really good. In animal experiments, fasting can extend lifespan, healthy lifespan, by a third. So there's a lot of animal evidence for fasting and more emerging human work. So I would say to people, if you can fast, great. Less on your plate. Just reduce what's on your plate by 20-25%, if possible. And then you won't be inclined to finish it all up, as your mother told you.
One of the issues that's arisen, I think in recent times, it's back in the news, with this recommendation from an Oireachtas committee to do with euthanasia and assisted dying. Mm. Do you have a view on that?
Oh, I'm very conflicted with the whole thing. I absolutely do believe in personal choice. And if the choice is well informed, and I think it's very difficult not to enable that. For older persons, one might be concerned that cognitive impairment, or nearly worse, a fear of imposing on people, might be the driving factor to accelerate death. And also, as a physician and a clinician, I would find it very difficult to deliberately end somebody's life. So I think there are a lot of aspects to this which are very complicated. It isn't simple, clearly. I think it needs to be much more, the debate needs to be much more detailed. I think it's a good step forward where we are asking people to actually declare what sort of death they would like, not ending life earlier, but actually, you know, under certain circumstances, do I want to be extensively resuscitated, etc., etc. And making those declarations in advance is important. And also making sure in plenty of time that you have taken care of your legal and financial affairs, so that that is a burden that you're not placing on others should there be an issue. So I think there are lots of things we can do to prepare. I'm not sure that we are nearly informed enough yet about euthanasia in our culture, because it can be quite culture specific. Mm.
To end on a more positive note, you've written in some detail about people living well beyond the century. I think in one case, a French woman living in past 120 years of age. Yeah. What are your hopes for yourself? I mean, how long would you like to be around the place?
She had a great life from get-go. She was very spoiled.
She was unburdened by, I suppose, hard chores.
She had a great life. She was high upper middle class. She lived to 122 and almost a half a year, so 122 and a half. And that's lifespan. So actually, from a science perspective, that's how long we know we can live. I would love to live that long if I was as well as she was. She was cognitively entirely normal. And her blood screen, done a year before she died, was entirely normal, which is remarkable. But she had a very privileged life. She was upper middle class. They always had servants. She did a lot of sports all year round, skiing, fencing, mountaineering, etc. So, you know, she had it good.
Well, sail Father Gwich. Good morning to one Cade, as they say, in the West and elsewhere. Professor Roseanne Kenny, thank you indeed for your insights.
Thank you.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.